Welcome all to Pick a Disc, the podcast where they pick them and then they talk about them. I'm your host Matthew Latham, and each episode a guest will appear on here and talk about an album that they want to talk about, be it a favourite or one they just like for some reason and just want to babble on. If they want to talk about it, they can do it here. For this first episode, the debut one, I spoke to Kurt North. Kurt is a podcaster from Up North and is an avid music fan himself. We talked about U2's Achtung Baby, how it was a departure from their older stuff, and how the state of the band affected its eventual output. It's definitely an album I've not listened to before, and U2 aren't really a band that I particularly like, but it was a nice album to perhaps start the podcast on. If you like what you hear, like us in the usual places, Twitter, Facebook, etc, etc, and add us on your favourite podcast catcher app of choice and do the 5-star iTunes thing that every podcast asks you to do. It might not deserve it yet, but it gives us something to talk about. Anyway, I've done rambling. Let's go to myself and Kurt North and talk about Achtung Baby. Okay, yeah. Kurt, welcome to Pick a Disc. Thank you for joining me.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
No problem. And I'll let you introduce the album that you're going to talk about.
Yeah, this album that I wanted to talk about today is one of the best albums that has ever been released, and it's U2's Achtung Baby.
Yeah, I think it's their seventh album, wasn't it, I think?
Yeah, seventh album, 1991.
Yeah.
Largely considered as probably one of three of their best albums that they've ever produced, so, and a really big turning point for them, which I'm sure we'll get into as we go through it.
Okay, the first question I'm going to be asking all my guests is just a very simple: why this album?
This album, I was 11, 12 at the time when the album was released. My mother was a huge U2 fan during when, obviously, the first 11 years that I was born. This album is a big change in direction from where they were in 1987 for Joshua Tree and from 1988-89 for Rattle and Hum. And she went completely off them, and I kind of joined the bandwagon at that point. And it has, for me, the real starting point of a lot of my kind of, what's the best way of putting it? The way that they changed direction, and it was talking to me more than a mother. And it's just a really interesting concept that she left at that point, and then I joined it, really. So it was kind of that, really.
So were you a fan of U2 before this album?
Yeah. I had to be. I mean, my mum has a great range in musical taste. She likes everything from Sisters of Mercy, The Mission, All About Eve, to David Bowie and Queen. But U2 was a really important band for them. So for her, and you know, I was into, at that point growing up, you know, Michael Jackson was the king of pop at that point. That was who I was, my favorite artist of all time, Michael Jackson. And going into my 11 to 13, 14, you know, you want to have something that's your own and something that you want to own yourself. And I felt that you two were the ones that were talking to me the most and shouted loudest to me.
Oh, okay. So before you listened to Achtung Baby, was you kind of, I mean, you was what, 11, 12? Was you kind of aware, yeah, of albums at the time, or the concept of an album, as in like a collection of songs? Not as a concept album, as in like a collection of songs as a capsule of their...
That makes the album itself.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say I didn't put as much as I do or have done over the years. Music has always been a really important part of my life, but it was more, in my head, more of a collection of songs. I mean, as I say, I was very narrow-minded, not narrow-minded, but very narrow in the songs I decided that I wanted to listen to. So Michael Jackson, as I say, was a massive part of my growing up. And there was a few artists here and there that I would listen to, but it was literally one or two, three people or three bands that I would physically listen to. So as an album, I just, you know, I just enjoyed their music. It wasn't till later on in life that I kind of got the concept of things like, you know, Dire Straits, The Wall, and things like that, with concept parts of having an album. And even now I'm reassessing, and I'm finding now that I'm looking more at things in meta, which I'm sure we'll talk about towards the end, of something that I've noticed even today's listening to the album that I hadn't realized before, which is quite meta. So yeah, I think the concept of an album and the collection of a group of songs with a grand theme behind it, I don't think I really would have picked that up to at least I was probably, you know, talking into late teens, maybe even the early 20s, really.
Oh, okay. So you've had your, so you're much of a U2 fan coming into this. this is like the first time I properly listened to this album, because I'm not much of a U2 fan, and as I think we've talked before the podcast brief, I'm not much a fan of Bono as a person. And there was the whole thing when they pretty much forced an album onto everyone who had an iPhone, and even though I didn't have an iPhone and was thankfully saved by that, there was something about that that kind of rubbed me up the wrong way as well. And I don't think that did them much favours, but
I think just touching on a couple of things you just mentioned there, just purely on that, while I think about it, the thing that I can completely understand with the U2 and obviously Chris Martin's taken the mantle of this a little bit as well from Coldplay, is that I can separate the two. And I think that some of the work that U2 have done is, for me, I mean, obviously I'm really biased, but coming from me, is takes a back seat. And even like the likes of The Edge and the rest of the band say that sometimes, you know, you can look at a piece of artwork and really enjoy it, but the person behind it is what people are against. And I've been to concerts, I've been to many concerts of U2's, and when he goes on his political rants, I get switched off. You know, it's not, for me, it's not so much about the, there is political aspects to it. My mum was involved with Amnesty International and things like that, so she was really into that side of things. Mm-hmm. But his preaching can go too far. So so I totally understand that. And I think detrimentally, sometimes the music suffers for it.
Yeah, I totally get that. I mean, again, it's funny you bring up Chris Martin. Chris Martin, I've got a love-hate relationship with him. Sometimes he gets on my nerves, but then sometimes he'll do something like the Game of Thrones musical sketch for like Comic Relief, and then I think he's great, and he's always someone you want at a charity gig. He knows how to do a charity gig, whereas, and then on the flip side, I think my anti-Bono is Dave Grohl. I mean, I think Dave Grohl is perhaps one of the nicest, he comes across as one of the nicest people in rock, but I just can't listen to the Foo Fighters. They've got some good singles, and that's about it. And it's kind of like the opposite of Bono, but for me, where I can't... Okay, well, not quite the opposite. I mean, I don't like Bono, and there's perhaps definitely one or two songs after listening to this album that I know quite a lot. But we'll probably go into it on. But it's interesting to say that, because particularly when you separate the artist from the band. So perhaps not just with Actung Baby, but as the band as a whole, is there quite a separation from Bono the person and U2's musical output, or is there a lot of crossover?
There is crossover. There's things like there's a recent song called Ordinary Love, which was I think it was for the film with Nelson Mandela in. I think it was that was a kind of a crossover. And there is, and this is something actually that's really interesting for as Actung Baby and some of the other stuff, is that before Actung Baby, there was songs like MLK and Pride in the Name of Love, which were a bit on the nose, though, kind of on, and the great tunes. I mean, everyone pretty much knows Pride in the Name of Love, which is a song about Martin Luther King. So there's that political aspect to him. He's also a heavy Christian as well. He had a Protestant, whichever way around. He had, his mother and father were opposites. I can't remember which way around it was. But so he's had an interesting life. His mother died when he was about 14 as well. So he's got a real religious background to him. He's obviously got this political standpoint where he runs from as well. And I think there is songs that do overlap. And in Actung Baby, it's probably not as vocal. It's more abstract than a lot of the other albums. So there is a bit of crossover. There is certain preachy songs, but for me, I don't think there is that much. But there may be some undertone or social commentary in certain songs. Bullet the Blue Sky from Joshua Tree is a perfect example, which is a fantastic song. It's all about a war-torn area, and that's very much about how America view things, and is very politically strong. But it's a really good song. And then obviously Something Close to His Heart, Sunday Bloody Sunday, is a really powerful song, which everyone knows, which is obviously about Bloody Sunday. So they're not adverse to going down that political route.
Okay, so perhaps before we go into like all the background and stuff, so let me say that again. Okay, so let's talk about the album itself and like some of the songs. I mean, again, I think when I first started listening to it, I found myself really liking Zoo Station as an opening track, and looking into it, there's some quite nice deliberate decisions in terms of trying to make people think that their stereo was broken by the from like the very broken start where they seem to keep starting over again, and it goes into this very like 90s industrial, almost nearly but not as dark, Nine Inch Nails style rock, which there's probably loads of bands that I probably either did it beforehand, but anything like that, it automatically reminds me of Nine Inch Nails.
Right, yeah. Well, the thing about that as well is Edge was really listening to a lot of electronic dance music and things like Nine Inch Nails and Young Gods and KMFDM. He was listening to a lot of that sort of stuff. He was really wanting something really edgy and really, pardon the pun, he was really wanting something quite dark. And as you said there about having the track, when people, they wanted to make people think that the vinyl was stuck or that something wasn't quite right. And it sounds so oblique from the what you do get from a normal U2 album. If you think of Joshua Tree, the first song on that album is Where the Streets Have No Name, which is really anthemic, you know, really kind of out there. Whenever they play it on stage, it's an amazing anthem. But this is really dark and gringy and it's metally and it's processed and everything like that. It's really powerful, and I think that they did a really good job of that. And not only that, this is part of what I was going to say later on, but the first couple of lines from that song is I'm ready for the laughing gas and I'm ready for what's next. So he's taking his usual social and political aspects of being quite earnest and being, I don't know what the other word would be, kind of fallible, and that you're coming out and saying this is going to be different, this is going to be more fun and something completely different to what you've heard before. And Zoo Station's a perfect way of starting it.
The Zoo Station's out of the way. In terms of the rest of the album, I know, I quite like that. When you come to re-listen to it, do you listen to it all the way through? Is there tracks that you jump to? Anything that stands out that you want to sing the praises of?
Well, the first one is, I do tend to listen to the album in its entirety. When I do listen to this album, I do think it's an album piece for me. It runs, apart from maybe one song, which is The Fly, which I was mentioning just in a second, that the album for me is a one piece of brilliant one concept in some ways, but it's just naturally flows for me as one album. That being said, I do want to mention that The Fly, and the reason why I want to mention The Fly is one, it's one of my favorite songs in U2's entire catalogue. I think it's a really upbeat, rocky number that they do. I've seen it live literally 2 or 3 months ago, and the Edge's solo, which he doesn't do a lot of. He tends to do solos that are more laid back and stripped back rather than going through like a ripping the chords and things like that. So he tends to like just pull back and use more of his sonic scape rather than going solo wise. But this solo is really, really good in The Fly. But not only that, The Fly knocked Bryan Adams' song from Everything I Do off the number one chart after 16 weeks or how many weeks it was. So purely on that, I absolutely love The Fly because it did knock that song off.
I was going to say, I was funny you mentioned that, because the other song that I really liked, I think it was two songs that I did come away saying almost changing my tune on YouTube, was Zoo Station and this one. There's a very, not as dirty as Zoo Station, but there's a very nice like dark sound to it, which I really liked, and kind of like chugging underneath, like under layer of sound, which I thought was really, really good. So it's funny you said that one straight away. So
yeah, I mean, The Fly is by far one of my favorite songs, as I say, of all time. I think because it's the thing about The Fly as well, it's something to look at, is you see the what U2 do best, and I think that many people would agree with this, is that their live tours are better than the songs on the albums. It actually comes alive in the live atmosphere.
Okay.
And they, with The Fly, they've messed around with that song so many different times on different tours that you're never sure which version you're going to get. You're going to get a brand new version. Do the same with Bullet the Blue Sky as well, which is one of my favorite songs. But they mess around with the actual way they play it depending on which tour they're on. So The Fly has got really heavy at one point on the Elevation tour, and you know, other versions, they've gone for a more stripped back version with a bit of piano in the background and things. And this one on the most recent tour is kind of just as it was on the album. So I think the songs do come a lot. I would say this for if I jump onto another song, Until the End of the World, I'd like to get your thoughts on that song. That song comes alive live. It doesn't really, for me, it doesn't really come across as well as a song on the album. I think it's to do with the production in my eyes. But when you watch that song live, it wasn't a single, but they've played that so many times live because it just works. So what did you think when you listened to that song?
See, I think you had the first two songs on the album, and then you have one, which I think is the song that I thought, oh, I know this one. This is the one I recognise. And then Until the End of the World, kind of like, I can't remember it. I mean, I've listened to the album about 3 or 4 times all the way through now.
Yeah.
And I can't remember how this one goes, if I'm completely honest. Because it then afterwards is Who's Going to Ride Your Wild Horses, which
yeah.
I, not as much as The Fly, but is a memorable one. Mainly, I think, probably because it reminds me of Wild Horses by the Rolling Stones. But it's, I think, Until the End of the World for me gets sandwiched between the song that I was aware of in the past in terms of one, and Wild Horses, which kind of grabbed my attention more because I think because of the phrase Wild Horses.
Right, so. Yeah. Well, Until the End of the World, it's until you know the background of it, it does come over. It was a film, a Wim Wenders film, that they released that for. But the actual song is a conversation between Jesus and Judas.
Oh, okay.
And so it's a conversation between the two of them. So when you look at it from that point of view, looking deeper into the lyrics, it actually becomes it's quite a brave song, because there's talk of an illicit encounter, and there's even, and this is something I wanted to pick up on as well, is that there's even connotations of oral sex in there, and there's kind of, there's this thing, you can take a number of different things from it. You can take it as like there's an illicit affair just on the side of things, but if you look at the Jesus and Judas and the Gardens of I can never say this word, I know it's in the X-Files as well, Gethsemane, so it's about the Gardens of Gethsemane. So there's a really deeper conversation and context with that one. And the lyrics, just so I'll just pick up on this, because throughout the whole album, and I didn't realize this until recent, there's connotations of oral sex right throughout the whole album. You've got in this one, it says, on Until the End of the World, it says, surrounding me, going down on me, spilling over the brim. In you mentioned Who's Going to Ride Your Wild Horses, that's got Who's Going to Taste Your Saltwater Kisses. And in Acrobat, he says, you can swallow or you can spit, you can throw it up or choke on it. So there's this theme of that going through the whole album. I'm just saying, where's that coming from?
I have no idea. Maybe it got lonely in the Berlin sessions. Got lonely in Berlin, which we'll talk about later on. But so, do you think that? Well, it's got to be slightly deliberate or accident. I'm not too sure. I mean, is there other moments that seem to share that, or other imagery that shares between different songs as well, as much as the oral sex?
I did mention this before. It's probably a good time to talk about it, I think. And this is either accidental or genius. So it's either one or the other. You can never know with these things, whether or not you're looking too deeply. But I was listening to the album today, and the first few songs are almost like they're talking to the audience because it's so different. So Zoo Station, you've got I'm Ready for the Laughing Gas, I'm ready for What's Next is the first opening line. And even better than The Real Thing, it's Give Me One More Chance and You'll Be Satisfied. Give Me Two More Chances and You Won't Be Denied. And then in one, Is It Getting Better or Do You Feel the Same? And then Until the End of the World, haven't seen you in quite a while. I was down here just hold passing time. So those opening lines of each of those songs are almost like the talking to the audience to say, look, I'm here. This is what we're doing. This is the difference that we're making. These are the changes. Is it getting better? Do you still feel that, you know, nah, it's not my U2? Or, you know, will it make it easy on you now that you've got someone to blame, that you can blame me because we've changed the way that U2 are? So I thought that was interesting reading on that just today, just when I was onto it.
So you got your first act of Achtung Baby, pun intended. So, like, do you think that kind of, if not theme, do you think, like, the other songs as you go through kind of share something as well? Or does it...
Yeah, I think the idea of them being more abstract and more, what's the word? I think they wanted to get, well, yeah, I mean, around this time, there was a lot of things going on with U2. One, they went to the Hansa Studios in Berlin to do the album. But Edge's marriage was going down the can. Adam was getting to the point, he gets this in 1993-94, where he misses a gig in Sydney, and they actually record live in Sydney. They actually had two nights where they were recording. One of them he didn't even make, and he's gone off a bit off the rails and was, you know, into the sex, drugs and rock and roll type thing. He was going out with Naomi Campbell and things like that. So that's kind of a little bit later on in the timeline. But you've got Adam going down that route. Larry wasn't really happy about the using drum loops, and there was a bit of fractious things happening there. And Edge and Bono were kind of doing their own thing in the corner, and there was this fraction of things not happening. But the idea of the album was that they were going to Berlin for a reason. It was the Berlin Wall had just come down. It was looking at the convergence of the end of the Cold War and the convergence of East to West. And, you know, Zoo Station's the perfect analogy because it's Zoo Bahnhof Station, which ironically has a U2 line, which actually goes from East to West, which is what I thought was quite ironic. I thought that was quite good. And the album was supposed to pull back from Rattlin' Hum. Ratland Hum was very much into rhythm and blues, getting Benny King. Benny King? Is it Benny King?
Benny King.
BB King. Benny King. Stand by me. But he was getting BB King down. They were going down the rhythm and blues idea, and they were going to Graceland and all these types of things for Ratland Hum. It's a fantastic sales album. It sold something like 14 million or something like that, but it was canned. The film was canned, and critically, it wasn't really planned quite well, and people just didn't like that album. Then you get to likes of Desire, where it starts talking about money, and there's a song called God Part Two, which you can see where Bono's wanting to take the band. They're kind of wanting to go down the more of a dancey beat fraction. So they wanted to pull away from that American aspect. So that going to Europe and going to Germany, the idea was to have that connotation of, you know, you've got more of the industrial aspects and the sounds and what is happening with the collapse of the wall and the Cold War and how people are feeling, and it's becoming a bit more hedonistic. And I think that does play throughout the album. There's a bit more of a party atmosphere, things like Mysterious Ways, which is all about how women can entice men, and you've got Until the End of the World, which has got potentially some illicit affair going on. It might even be between two homosexuals, and there is a lot of like European thought and standards coming in. Even one has a connotation of, from the video, that there is a connotation of AIDS as well. So I think that is the kind of the concept and the idea of the album.
Funny when you talk about the fractured nature of U2 at the time, we'll probably perhaps go into the behind the scenes section of the album, in terms of, from what I've been reading about it, they tried to perhaps go away to try and find themselves again, because this was in the middle of their longest like quiet period, wasn't it, something at the time.
In the Love Town tour, they did while they were doing Ratland Hum, they went around America in a tour called the Love Town tour, and I think it was New Year's Eve 1989, I think it might have been. They'd been touring for quite some time at that point. That, you know, they'd come off the back of Joshua Tree, and Ratland Hum was a commercial, if not critical failure, but commercial success. And he said on stage, that's the end of something for you two, and we have to go away and dream it all up again. And that was the point where they said, we've got to change, we've got to do something different. So that's kind of where it was at that point. And then obviously we then get them doing a couple of things. I think Bono did a song, Night and Day, which was a cover, which is more dancey. So that's the kind of route that they wanted to go down. They thought that the 1984, say, Unforgettable Fire up until Ratland Hum was kind of the end of an era, and they needed to move on.
Yeah, and as I was reading about the history as well, they kind of experienced a bit of Berlin. And 90s Berlin, that industrial sound, that there's all, you kind of get that. Mm. I don't know, that sound always seems to remind me of Germany. I've never been to Germany.
Right.
But I don't know whether it's that kind of Europe. There's almost European dance, but slightly darker element to industrial that I think always reminds me, like Steel and like the Berlin Wall with like all its graffiti on. That kind of matches that kind of industrial music. And then when other stories I've been reading as well, like there's one point where, I don't know whether it's just as the wall was being torn down, they was looking for celebrations, and they ended up in a party that was actually against the wall coming down by mistake, which I found quite funny. But from what I've been reading as well, they seem to not, the Berlin experiment wasn't exactly a success. And I, ironically, perhaps realizing that, kind of ended up bringing them back together when they went back to Dublin to finish or to do the rest of the album. Is that right?
Yeah. What happened was that they did the album. There's a great documentary which I have yet to see. It's called From the Sky Down, which I need to get. I haven't got that yet. I need to get that. That's all about this era and what happened. But they were really going for this. They had an engineer called Flood, who's been with them for quite some time after this album. They do pop and various other things. And it was a difference of opinions and all this work that they did, and they put 3 months of work into it and came out with two songs, and that was it. That's all they came out with from the Berlin experiment. Now, but what they did was, they had Brian Eno. Now, obviously, Brian Eno is quite famous for the stuff that he's been involved in, like Roxy Music and Ultravox, and, you know, Bowie. He did some Bowie stuff as well. And I think it may have even been at Hansa Studios that he did the work for the Berlin Trilogy that Bowie did. But he was in part of the the album as such. And I think there was a genius bit of work this, because Brian O'Neill's been really involved in them, but he took more of an advisory role. So what they said was, what U2 had gone to them and said, we want to do the album, want to record the album, but we don't want Brian Eno being there. We want him to be the fresh pair of eyes to see what it sounds like when you come to look at it as a completely fresh pair of eyes. We want to make sure that all the U2-ness has been taken away from it. So when they had all this trauma of, you know, as I say, Edge like sort of going through his marriage problems, and they were writing stuff about that, and you've got Bono going through a stage in LA in the late 80s where he was drinking a lot and things like that, which seeps into the album. But they go away, and there's it was quite ironic actually. They actually disappeared and went back to Dublin, but they left some of the recordings, I think, in Germany, and they got picked up. And it actually worked really well for me down there. A few years later, I was able to get a copy of the bootleg version of those songs, and you can hear some of the songs now they've developed, which was really nice to do that. But Brian Eno basically came in and was like, right, okay, this is the art, this is the song, these are the songs that we've got. They're all rap, basically. But Brian Eno came and said, actually, you've got the workings of a good album here. You just need to tidy them up and sort them out. They're not as bad as you thought. So with a bit of time and with a bit of distance and with a bit of objectivity, they actually looked at it, and some of the work they had was actually worth going back through again. So even though it was supposedly a really bad time, and it was, and I think they needed to go through that as a band, what came out or what they could salvage from it actually worked quite well when they went back to Dublin.
Oh, okay. So yeah, I was reading about that, and so you think that kind of stuff kind of helped kickstart the second half of the recording of the album?
Yeah, because if you listen to some of the bootlegs, you'll hear like about three or four songs. Ultraviolet, Like My Way, which is on the album, you'll hear that in Mysterious Ways. I think one came out of a section of a middle eight from Mysterious Ways. They went, well, that's a really nice chord structure, that could be a song on its own. So that came from Hansa Studios. But then you've got Like My Way, which was, I think it was Lady with the Spinning Head, and that song, Lady of the Spinning Head, which is obviously on the bootleg, ended up being three songs on the album. They actually split what was on there into three. So the melody of one, the bass line of another, and something else of another. So there was stuff there that was workable.
Oh, okay. So, and I want to ask you about The Fly again, but not The Fly the song. Apparently, there's a character that Bono called The Fly.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
So, just explain. Can you explain?
I can. As part of when they were, it was actually Zoo Station, as it happens, that's where it kind of started to formulate. What Bono wanted to do was he wanted, like everyone did, they wanted it to sound different. They wanted it to sound as unlike U2 as possible, but maintaining the band structure that they've got. So they came back with Zoo Station. Zoo Station wasn't sounding too... There was something not quite right. It sounded like Bono, and he was like, well, I want it to sound different. Can we play around with it? So he asked The Flood to play around with it, make it sound like it came come through a megaphone. And then this weird thing started to happen, and it happens more in Zooropa, the follow-up EP, where he started to develop two different voices. So you're hearing things like, I think Even Better Than The Real Thing probably has it, where he's got a lower register voice and he's singing an octave higher as well. So there's actually two Bono singing at the same time, but it's just an octave of each other rather than being a third or a fifth in harmony. It's more just literally just the octave. So as he was developing that, one of the things that came out of it was The Fly. So The Fly came out, they were recording, he actually started wearing the sunglasses and wanted to, and he felt that it needed to be a different character. And The Fly's he throws off, I can't remember what the word is, an aphorism, I think it's called, all his one line words, you know. So the secret of the stars are falling from the sky, it's no secret that the world is in darkness tonight, they say a secret is something. There's all like just one, these scattered lines throughout the song, and it was talking about the megalomania of like entertainment and the way that, you know, this fly personality was on the edge of going insane, and the way he could do that was to transform himself into that character. And as we mentioned before about it beat obviously number one to the Bryan Adams song, that is my first recollection of this new U2, because that was the first single. And if don't know if you've seen the video to it, but the video was on Top of the Pops, as we had years ago, where it was brilliant Top of the Pops. Mm-hmm. And it was of Bono wearing leather pants, leather jacket, completely alternate to what he's been in the past, with his black shades on, in front of a London bus, with a toy London bus pushing it down the road in the middle of London. And it was like, what on earth is going on here? And the show business side of me, being a massive Michael Jackson fan, seeing some of the stuff that he did in the Bad Tour and things, you know, a big show. And then you next see him sitting there in front of a wall full of 4x3 TVs, as they were then, in a window of a TV rental shop, with all this information flying at him. And then the song comes in, and that point, the fly was born. And that's where that came from. But that then spawned the tour. So Zoo TV came about, and a new character was formed, and that's probably for another day. But the a person called McFisto arrived, and McFisto actually ends up on the Batman film.
Okay.
I think Batman Forever. That's the song called "Hold Me, Throw Me, Curse Me, Kill Me," and the video is actually McFisto.
Oh, I think I've seen that because I really got into Batman Forever when I was young, because I remember seeing at the cinema and got quite obsessed with the film at one point. And I think I remember that actually, because it was on. I think I never got the soundtrack fully, but I think there was that, and there was "Kiss by a Rose" by Seal. That was from the film as well. I completely forgot that was part of that film.
Yeah. So that song, I mean, I know we're not talking about that. That was a single, so that was in between. It was meant to be on, I think it was, if my memory serves me right, it was either going to be on Zooropa or it was going to be on Achtung Baby. They had the workings of it, and then it became the Batman song.
So
I was just going to say, so it was going to be in the Batman film, but nobody watching it would have seen McFisto in it. It was a cartoon character, McFisto. What McFisto was a tired old rock star. He was wearing like gold and like platform heels, and he would talk very much, "My lovely fellas," and very kind of like English and with devil horns and stuff like that. And he became, McFisto became a character of about three or four characters that Bono had made, and that was all from The Fly.
So, and was that the genesis of Bono wearing those sunglasses?
Yes.
Yeah, so he never took them off afterwards.
He never took them off, but he does say that I don't know when this happened, but he has got an eye condition, so he actually does wear them for a medical reason.
Oh, okay.
So the beginning of the sunglasses was definitely at that point, yeah.
Oh, okay. Before we move on to the last part, which is talking about the reception of it, I was going to ask you another personal question.
Mm.
Is there a song that you don't like or like the least out of the others? It's 55 minutes long, and I like my album shorter than that. I mean, to me, between 30 and 40 minutes, not too hard being tight for that.
Right.
So I've got albums that I will skip a track. If you was at a push, which track would you skip, or which is your?
Well, I was thinking about this today, and I'm looking at the list now. I would probably, if I had to skip one, it would fall between two, really. It'd be either "Trying to Throw My Arms Around the World" or "So Cruel," but I think it would be "Trying to Throw Your Arms Around the World," which is about a hangover, which is great. I love the song. I don't think it's a bad song by any means, but from albums moving on after this album, there is not a trial to replicate that, but it becomes almost formulaic that you've got to have a song like that, or there's a song slightly the same as that, and it becomes a bit more formulaic as it goes on, that you kind of have that type of song. It's a bit slower. It has it obviously has some deep connotations about when he was in LA, which I mentioned before. "So Cruel" is another slow mid-tempo one as well. But I think "Trying to Throw My Arms Around Your Arms Around the World" is probably the one I would, if I had to push for one to go, that would be the one.
Okay. And let's have a quick chat about the album cover. Because I think a key part of any album is how it's presented. And you'll probably know a bit more about me. This is apparently another departure from the previous albums, where apparently there's a lot more monochrome and not, I don't want to say bland, but there was a very uniform style to them.
Anton Corbin is responsible for a lot of U2 stuff. But the earlier albums, you're right, Boy was a picture of just a boy. War was a picture of a boy. Well, the same boy, actually, as it happened, with a war helmet on, you know, and it was very kind of understated, but a political statement. So you're looking at that, even like sort of October was a mainly white, but with just a general picture in the middle. Then you've got Unforgettable Fire, that was more of an orangey, reddy colour because of the album name, really, and a picture of where they recorded it. Joshua Tree, again, was a picture of the Joshua Tree, which was kind of faded out a little bit as well, and was kind of, I can't remember if it's black or white, or it's definitely not saturated very well. And because of the change of direction, they've gone for something completely different and colourful. And so one of the good things, I don't know if you know, that the album might have been called Adam, and that's after Adam Clayton, the bass player. And it's a now famous picture between the U2 fan community of Adam basically stark bollock naked, just a picture of him and with everything out, and that was going to be the album cover for a brief time, which I quite like. But I think the reason why they probably didn't go down that road, there's a few other things that they want to try, was they were going to say, oh, look, this is U2 making another big statement. So they wanted to go for something a bit different. So having a colourful album cover with loads of different pictures, I think works. And I think that they wanted it to be, you know, because even now, if I thought, I'm looking, I can see the album cover in front of me, but I couldn't probably tell you what was on the album cover, because there's so many different pictures, you know, that's the album cover. That's what it's recognizable for. So yeah, so going for that multicolored aspect was really interesting.
I think it kind of matches, I think, the album sound as well, in that it's throwing quite a lot of different things. So you've got your kind of single monochrome section. I think first column, third one down, someone's holding what looks like a snake, which is a very basic black and whitish picture, which I think kind of reflects their older style. But then you've got, then in the top right hand corner, you've got it looks like a painting, or at least a painting superimposed over the band. I'm assuming next to it is a picture of Berlin.
Right, yeah.
I
would assume. I don't.
Yeah, but yeah, it's a lot. It's very colourful. It's quite, it's interesting. It's a nice, it's like a collage of, you can kind of tell it's like a journey to get there, and it's kind of like compressing all that down. And I'm quite impressed at the album cover itself.
Yeah, and another thing that catapults into is when they do go into Zoo TV. Zoo TV becomes, you know, one of the great masterpieces of you know, U2 then became famous for their shows, because the shows were just ridiculous. Like Pop Mart had a ridiculously half McDonald's sign, because they were talking about commercialism, and like a massive, at the time, massive, like, you know, 80-foot screen or whatever it was. It was huge, massive, huge, and it'd come out of a lemon, so which was completely random. But Zoo TV had the Trabans, the European cars that you can see. I think it's like the third one across and third one down, the Trabant car, which is known in Germany for a lot of for getting around in. And they had them hanging up on the ceiling, and they would do all of these, like, shows where they're linked to Sarajevo at some point, which goes back to that political thing we were talking about before. But there was a link of all this communication coming to you at once. The Fly does that really well on the screen, where when you watch it on Zoo TV, that there's just words just being fired at you as if you're taking too much on board, and, you know, so much information there, you just can't physically take it in. And I think that's the beginning of that is from Ak Chung Baby in the front cover, and obviously like the Fly when the when you watch the video and you see all the TVs in the wall.
So, and that was on the Zoo TV tour as well.
Zoo TV.
Did you see that live?
I didn't. No, I didn't pick up seeing U2 until the Elevation tour in 2001. I was going to go in 97, but I went to see Michael Jackson at Wembley instead, so I missed the Pop Mart tour. That's where I wanted to get to, but I was too young and didn't have enough money at the time. So,
oh, okay. So, how many times have you seen U2 live?
About 7 or 8.
7 or 8, and yeah. Oh, always good.
Yeah, yeah. There's been some interesting ones. I was luckily there where they've got a book called U2 by U2, where they had one of the first major not disasters, but they had a massive sound problem with a song called Walk On, and we couldn't hear him. We couldn't hear any of them. It just went off. And it's mentioned in that book, so I quite like the you know, it's actually written down somewhere that happened at my gig when I went to see him in Glasgow. That was in 2009, I think. So yeah, so I've been basically, I'm not as avid a fan as, like, I'd go to 3 or 4 of the same tour. I generally try and get to, well, I do get to every tour, once every tour pretty much.
Oh, okay.
So that's what I tend to do. Yeah.
Okay, so before we wrap up, we're just going to briefly talk about the reception of the album and what some of the people said. And it's basically notes that I took from Wikipedia, if I'm honest. But and what got me was, this is a band's 7th album. I mean, some bands struggle to do a good second one. And from what I'm gathering here, a load of the critics are just saying that this could arguably be their best. There's a lot of similarities like from an album later on, Kid A by Radio, which may be a future episode, hint, hint.
Right.
where in terms of a complete contrast in sound. There's a lot, and I mean a lot of praise. I've lost the quote, but someone mentioned that when someone makes a very distinct change in sound, it converges on self-parody, yet this album kind of doesn't. It actually feels like that. Someone mentioned, man, I really should, note to self.
Future episodes, I'll write them down.
Future Matthew, who's listening to this, cite your Sorry, the reception beat a lot better. Yeah, someone else has said that gives... Okay, here we go. Robert Hilburn at the Los Angeles Times says that it gives them the most confident sound ever. They somehow managed to maintain U2 sound, yet sound completely different. And it's just like all music has got full marks. Q, full marks. Los Angeles Times, 4 out of 5. Entertainment Weekly gave it an A. Metacritic gives it 93 out of 100. Yeah. It's just loads and loads of just praise throughout the board. Question for you as the YouTube fan, is it better than Joshua Tree?
So this is one of the defining moments of of questions that you could do. I personally think it is. I like experimentation, but I also, it's like in my TV viewing, I like that darker stuff. Joshua Tree is fantastic, but as I get further towards the end of the album, it can at some point wane a little bit. There's some fantastic songs in there, and it is, by standard, it's one of the best albums, again, one of the best albums it's ever been. But for me, I think that Chung Baby's probably got it more as an album piece than Joshua Tree, but Joshua Tree has got some of the best songs on there. I think that's probably the best way of putting it. I think as an album, Chung Baby's better, but Joshua Tree's probably got the better songs.
Oh, okay.
See what I mean?
Yeah. So if like me, this was perhaps the first proper album this is the first proper album of U2 I probably listened to all the way through. I'm oohing and ahhing about whether... Actually, no, I'm probably going to reveal what the first episode of this podcast is going to be beforehand so that people can perhaps listen in advance. Listen in advance. So if anyone who's actually listened to this for the first time and then have gone, oh, actually, I might listen to more U2, what would you recommend their next step be? So if they want to listen to more U2, where should they go?
I think if they like Tak Chung Baby as an album, I think they have to go with the next one, Zooropa. Zooropa is a push on from what they've already done in Tak Chung Baby. Mm-hmm. It has some of the same kind of feelings to it. It's got the disco beat to it. It's got some further pushing of the boundaries to what they need to, what they actually do from Tak Chung Baby onwards. And it's a fantastic album. But for me, if you're going to listen to a generic, not generic, but a basic album by album, there's three albums you need to listen to. It's Tak Chung Baby, it's The Joshua Tree, and it's got to be All That You Can't Leave Behind, which was the 2001 album as well. Those are the three that are held up to high esteem.
The Holy Trinity of U2 albums. Okay, and before we leave you, I'm going to ask you a question now. My long-term vision is to eventually have a really long playlist on Spotify where the guest chooses one song to add to the album, chooses one song to add to this playlist. Now, okay, I'm going to ask you to choose one song to be immortalised forever, or for as long as Spotify exists, in the Pick a Disc playlist, right, of Hall of Fame, which I will accept suggestions for better names. pick for the playlist or something.
Right, okay. So you talked about Zoosation and The Fly being the two that kind of jumped out at you the most.
Yeah.
If I was to choose, I think I'd choose one of them. And I think The Fly, as much as I love it and I think it's a fantastic song, is a bit more generic and a standard song. I think Zoosation is the most unique. So I'm going to go with Zoosation. And that will probably be hopefully your playlist open.
Yeah, I think this is going to be the opening of the playlist. And it's a good choice. I was hoping you'd say that. So, so Zoosation, congratulations. You're the first entry on the Pick a Disc Playlist Hall of Fame. Patent pending on the name. Yes, if anyone's listening and can think of a better name for the Playlist Hall of Fame or whatever, let me know. So, Kurt, thank you so much for being my guinea pig for this podcast. So it's been a lot of fun, quite a lot of fun, particularly for me. One of the main reasons that I decided to do this was to broaden my listening and to listen to stuff that I would not listen to, and picking a band that I wouldn't have openly listened to in the first place. But I think it's given me a different view of you two anyway. Perhaps not of Bono.
I don't think you can ever change your opinion of Bono. No. You either love him or hate him.
But so. I think I'm going to be a bit more open-minded with you two in the future anyway. So I might give some of the albums another go. Thank you for that.
No problem.
So before you go, if anyone wants to find you, if you've got anything you want to shill, I know you've got a podcast yourself. Yep. So, yep, the floor is yours.
We can find me generally on Twitter, and my handle is at rmuldrake. So that's rmuldrake. That's a play on a character episode in The X-Files. And you can look up my podcast, which again is similar to yours, Matt. It's quite a word in title, which is Pick Up a Podcast. So try saying that five times quickly. So and that's to say you can find me on Twitter at Pick Up a Podcast.
Thank you for that, Kurt. And please give him a follow and listen to his podcast as well. I know you're also on the X-Cast, which is my good friend Tony Black's X-Files extravaganza, like, empire got.
And, it's certainly an empire, isn't it? It's growing to be that way.
Well, again, thank you. And perhaps we could have you on again talking about something else in the future.
I'd be happy to come on and with you two or otherwise. I've got a wide range of music. I play in a band, so I know my music quite well. So I'd be more than happy to come on again.
Oh, thank you very much. You've been listening to Pick a Disc. I've been your host, Matthew Latham. Our theme music is Pump by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com. You can find us on all your favourite podcast apps of choice, but you can also find us on Anchor, who also hosts us. You can find us in all the usual social media type places like Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, under the tag Pick a Disc. Until next time, happy listening to all of those discs that you are picking.